Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about this subject. Hopefully the talk will be a little less long-winded than the title. And this is based on a paper that should be appearing hopefully within the next week or so with Ann Nelson and two of her students. Okay, so here's the outline. I'll first give a lightning review of dark matter and structure formation. Review what physics sets the scales of the dark matter halos that we see today. Then talk about what we know about the sizes of these halos. Of course, I wouldn't be talking about this if there weren't possibly problems. Then I'll talk about a particle physics solution to maybe some of these potential problems. In particular, strong interactions between dark matter and neutrinos. So this has been thought about in an effective field theory point of view before, and so we'd like to ask the question what an actual UV-complete model might look like. And once you write down a UV-complete model, then you can start asking questions about other observables and what the implications are. Okay? So here's the obligatory why dark matter slide. We know that there's some component of the universe that's that we don't see in photons through a number of pieces of evidence. So one, maybe the simplest one to understand is galactic rotation curves. So we can look at galaxies and then plot what the radial velocity of the stars is in a galaxy as a function of its distance from the center. And then compare that, so this is data from one particular galaxy, compare that to the velocity that we would expect given the amount of matter that we can see. We'd expect something falling off with increasing radius, and we see something that's actually just flattening out. So that leads us to infer that there's some non-luminous component of matter that's influencing the stars that we see through their gravity. Another way that we can infer the presence of dark matter is by looking at the collisions of galaxy clusters like this the famous bullet cluster. So what you see here in these colors is the matter that we know about through X-ray observations, and then these contours show us where the matter that is interacting gravitationally via gravitational lensing of stuff behind this colliding cluster, where that sits, and you can see that they don't overlap, and so you know we're led to infer the presence of matter that we don't see. And probably the strongest piece of information about the possible existence of a particle that doesn't interact with photons very strongly, but does interact gravitationally, comes from observations of the CMB. So there are, one can extract the amount of such matter by looking at the ratios of the heights of these acoustic peaks in the CMB, and then you're led to a paradigm where there's about 5 times more dark matter than visible matter. Sure. Sure. Great.
About so-called dark matter.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, this talk isn't about those, but you know, sure, there's other possibilities, perhaps, but we're going to be working in the paradigm where there is some particle, a dark matter particle that also can explain these in a very crisp way. Okay. So now we'll talk about, if that's the case, what how structure in the universe forms. So one fact about the universe that we live in is that it's expanding and cooling, and there was an initial period of inflation. And so so the picture that you should have is of gravitational perturbations, or density perturbations, I should say, that have characteristic scales, and then because the universe is expanding, the horizon size is increasing, and perturbations that have characteristic scales that are, the ones that have smaller characteristic scales enter the horizon first, and then can, so then they're in causal contact and they can start to grow and so forth, and then perturbations with larger scales enter later. So the picture is one of dark matter perturbations on smaller scales entering the horizon earlier when it was hotter, smaller clumps forming, and then these clumps in a hierarchical sort of manner aggregating and forming larger and larger clumps. But the basic take-home message is that small-scale structures form earlier in the universe. And the, the gravitational clumping of perturbation or density perturbation over densities is a competition between the gravitational force that wants to force these things to collapse and the pressure that these that the overdensities feel, which resist that collapse. Okay. So now, figuring out when things do collapse requires figuring out when dark matter feels a pressure. So it does feel a pressure if it's coupled to the relativistic fluid that that is the standard model photons and electrons and so forth early in the universe. So that coupling imparts a pressure that the dark matter feels, which resists its gravitational collapse. So this is some kind of cartoon about that. The dark matter feels this pressure as long as it's in some thermal equilibrium with the relativistic plasma of the standard model. And this this interaction will damp structure on scales that are smaller than the horizon at that up until the time at which the dark matter decouples from that plasma. And so you can estimate what that that size is, and then turn that into a go from a distance to a mass by just multiplying by the dark matter density. You get something like this. And so you'll notice that the this tells you the smallest mass objects that can exist based on the temperature at which the dark matter decouples from the plasma. And so you can see as you push the temperature down, then the dark matter is staying in equilibrium to later and later times. And so the smallest structure that you can form, the mass of that thing will increase. Okay, so this is just putting into a somewhat more quantitative form what I was talking about earlier. Yeah, so I'll in a couple slides, actually next slide, talk about estimating what this decoupling temperature is.
But fundamentally, we don't know when it decouples, is it?
Yeah. So we just... that's right. We don't know yet. That's right. So, okay. We'd like to estimate that temperature at which the dark matter decouples from the relativistic plasma. So at that point, the dark matter is non-relativistic and its momentum looks like this, where T is the temperature. And the condition for it to remain in thermal equilibrium is that it can scattering off of the plasma imparts a order one momentum change to the dark matter. So if there's n scatterings in some period of time, then the plasma carries a momentum that's roughly equal to the temperature. And so the total change of the momentum is related to the temperature in this way and the number of scatterings. And if we want that to be of the order of the dark matter momentum, then it tells us how many scatterings we need in some period of time. And then we can compare the rate for that process or for that many scatterings, which is dependent on the size of the cross-section for interaction between the dark matter and the radiation and the number density of the radiation. So we can compare that to the Hubble scale And so long as that scattering rate is larger than the Hubble scale, then the dark matter remains in thermal equilibrium. And then you can, if you write down some form for this cross-section in terms of a scale lambda, so as you increase lambda, the coupling between dark matter and the plasma gets weaker. You can solve for what the decoupling temperature is. And so this formula shows you that behavior, where if we push lambda up, the decoupling temperature increases, so the dark matter goes out of equilibrium earlier. Right? And conversely, if we push it down, then the interaction is stronger, the dark matter remains in equilibrium to later times.
You need at least a logarithmic growth in structures from the horizon entry until decoupling in order to get things to work right.
Okay.
So,
I mean, am I supposed to be defending dark matter here, or?
This is a decoupling.
You are defending.
No, you're not defending this.
This has to be the case.
Sure.
Otherwise you can't get structure growth.
Okay.
But it's not the same decoupling this one. Right? This is a decoupling of dark matter.
Yeah, this is not
this is not its going out of chemical equilibrium, but this is thermal equilibrium.
The baryons pressure. Because that you have to fit the height of the power spectrum to 1%.
Sure.
So the dark matter has to be somewhat collisionless.
Yes. So there's a there's a lower bound on lambda, so it can't. So, in other words, this cross section can't be super duper huge. Okay, and then I'll just mention one other source of a potential scale that sets a cutoff in the sizes of the smallest dark matter objects that can exist. And this is somewhat more intuitive. So here's a picture of, you know, dark matter kind of forming some structure here. However, it can free stream, and the length that it can free stream will tell you that structures smaller than that length cannot form. So you can estimate that size and turn it into a mass in the same way as before. Essentially, here it's basically just the velocity of the dark matter between the decoupling temperature and the present day. And it turns out that basically for any of the scenarios that we're going to be talking about, the previous estimate of the cutoff is the stricter one, and so that's the one that actually sets the scale. So ignore that last slide. So in other words, the cutoff is given by the scale of these acoustic oscillations, and it's related to the decoupling temperature in this way. Okay. So now we can ask what we expect in, say, a vanilla WIMP scenario. So a WIMP scenario just means that the scale of this cross section is, you know, 100 GeV, TeV, something like that. So then we can go back and plug that value into the formula for kinetic decoupling and figure out when at what temperature the decoupling happens. And you know, typically it's of the order 10 MeV or so if you're living in just a vanilla WIMP scenario. Then if you go back and figure out what cutoff on dark matter halo sizes that implies, it's quite a small cutoff. Okay? So then we can look at the data and ask what that says.
Sorry, that's a pretty minimal
cutoff. The point is, yeah, this is a small number. This is a small mass. That's the point. But yeah, I mean, the particular number there is not too important. So what we can do is to, one handle that we have on the sizes of dark matter halos is to look at satellite dwarf spheroidal galaxies of the Milky Way. And then compare those against what we observe in a n-body simulation, which is essentially, you can view that as a proxy for this vanilla WIMP scenario. And so you can plot the number of these satellite galaxies as a function of their mass. And the black is what n-body simulations lead you to expect. Then you can go out and actually do the observations, and you see this blue. And so the missing satellites problem is the statement that down here at somewhat smaller halo masses, there's some discrepancy between expectation and observation. Okay, so these satellites are missing. This could be due to observational biases, but you know, most statements of this missing satellites problem take that into account. And what I mean there is just that the smaller galaxies or dwarf galaxies or satellites rather are less luminous and harder to see. So you know, there's some correction factor that you have to apply, but it's likely not enough to make up for this several orders of magnitude discrepancy. And then the fact that the discrepancy exists below about 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 solar mass for halos that are below about 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 solar masses is suggestive of some cutoff in the power spectrum at about that value. Okay, so that's just one of the so-called dark matter substructure problems. Two others go by the name Too Big to Fail and Corvus Cusp. So Too Big to Fail, you can tell when people were worrying about that problem based on its name. And that's essentially just some kind of a crystallization of the missing satellites problem. So maybe I should go back to this previous slide. Let's see. So like I was saying, there could be some, you know, maybe there's some observational bias here where the smaller halos are less likely to form stars and then harder to detect. Maybe we just don't understand star formation all that well. The too big to fail problem is that if we go, so this is a picture of a dark matter simulation. If we go and then around a Milky Way sized halo, ask what the masses of the largest satellite halos are, and then compare those to the masses of the largest ones that we see. We see that the n-body simulations imply that the most massive satellite satellites should be more massive than they are. And so, in other words, those probably suffer from far smaller observational biases, because if they're larger than the largest ones that we do see, then they're presumably, you know, we can see them. So, so that's, they're too big to fail to form stars and be seen. Then Corvus Cusp is the statement that n-body simulations imply that the dark matter density should increase as you go towards the center of a halo. And so that's given by some kind of an NFW type profile that looks like this as a function of radius. Then you can go and look at dwarf galaxies and ask what the dark matter density there looks like. And it looks a little bit less cuspy than an NFW type profile and more cored. So that's termed the Corvus Cusp problem. And these are all of these problems have to do with dark matter structures at the galactic or subgalactic scales. So potentially they're all related to one another. Okay, so there are, you know, people have identified these problems and then also potential resolutions of these problems. So one of those is there could be effects from including baryons. And when astronomers say baryons, they mean baryons and leptons, which is entertaining. So by including the effect of those on the dark matter, or on or properly accounting for star formation and so forth, the dark matter could be warmer than expected. So that would be indicative of a longer free streaming length than the one that that I was talking about previously. It could self-interact, and doing so might make cuspy profiles less cuspy. And then the other possibility is that the dark matter actually stays in equilibrium with the relativistic plasma to lower temperatures, which washes out smaller structures. And that's the tack that I'll take. So if you want dark matter to stay in equilibrium longer, then basically you can either couple it to photons or to neutrinos, which are also a form of radiation at these temperatures. Coupling dark matter to photons seems, you know, tricky. So let's consider coupling it to neutrinos. Okay, and so just recall from a previous slide that the cutoff is the cutoff in the matter power spectrum is related to the decoupling temperature, like this. And the missing satellites problem implies that there's potentially a cutoff in the 10 to the 8 solar mass region here. So that implies a decoupling temperature of a keV. Okay. Then we can go back to our cross section for the scattering of the dark matter on radiation, in this case neutrinos, parameterize it in some general way, and then ask what the strength of this interaction has to be to get a decoupling temperature of a keV. Okay, and so that tells you that the scales that are in this problem are in the kind of tens of MeV range. And then incidentally, so here's some kind of a diagram that describes the interaction of dark matter and neutrinos. So this diagram is what you use to get the form of this cross section. And then you can turn it around and ask what the annihilation cross section is for dark matter to annihilate into neutrinos. And given these sorts of scales, the annihilation cross section is a lot larger than the canonical thermal relic cross-section that one needs to get the observed dark matter density, which tells you that you know, if this is going to be a viable scenario, then we need some kind of an asymmetric dark matter picture. And so then we can ask what a model, an actual, you know, beyond just writing down some blob here, what an actual UV complete model might look like. So if we're coupling to neutrinos, and we want to do so in a way that will embed into the standard model nicely, and then to not also interact with charged particles because of strong constraints, then that motivates thinking about the neutrino portal, where you can couple to the gauge singlet that you form out of the lepton doublet and the Higgs doublet. So this is a gauge singlet. So you could imagine tacking on another gauge singlet to make a renormalizable operator. That could be dark matter. But doing this generically will lead to dark matter decay, and that's not good. So you can get around that by adding another field to this operator. Then it's higher dimensional. This other field can be heavier than the dark matter, and then also be charged under some symmetry that ensures the stability of the dark matter, okay? So since this is a some higher dimensional operator involving the neutrino portal and the dark sector, one way of generating that is to add a sterile neutrino, which couples the neutrino portal to the dark sector. So you can do that by we introduce some sterile neutrino called N. It has some coupling to the neutrino portal, like this. and it also has some interaction with the dark sector. So chi will be our dark matter candidate here, and phi is some other mediator also charged under the dark symmetry. Then if we integrate out the sterile neutrino, we can generate this effective operator and then generate an effective dark matter neutrino interaction like so. Okay. Then the cross section for dark matter scattering on a neutrino through this process, or through a diagram that looks like that, is given by this. And the coupling that sits out in front of here is related to this Yukawa interaction in the dark sector between the sterile neutrino and the dark matter, and the mixing angle between the sterile neutrino and the light neutrinos, which is related to the light neutrino mass and the sterile neutrino, or the heavy, mostly sterile neutrino, like so. And as I was saying before, you know, all of the scales in this cross section need to be tens of MeV. So matching back onto the previous parameterization of the cross section, the scale lambda is roughly the mediator scale divided by this coupling here, and it needs to be tens of MeV. And we can't have phi be too small, so g needs to be kind of order 1-ish, order 0.1, say. And if that's the case, then this mixing angle needs to be large. So that means that this mostly sterile neutrino needs to be quite light, so kind of EV scale. And that's just, that's not bad. I mean, that's not good. That is bad. So that simple model doesn't work. Okay. So what you do is, when one sterile neutrino doesn't work, you just add another, and hope for the best. This one, it's actually so it's Dirac. It's not pseudo Dirac in this particular case. I mean, I guess in general it could be pseudo Dirac, but. No, there's still, so, all right, I'll talk about the model and then I'll tell you why it's Dirac, but, okay, so now what we do is to, so the problem previously was that the coupling between the light neutrinos and the sterile neutrino was not, or the model that I wrote down before wasn't conserving lepton number, and that means that the light neutrino mass is related to the sterile neutrino mass, or the heavy neutrino mass. And so one way we can break that relation is to impose lepton number as a symmetry. So everything to the right of this point in the Lagrangian conserves lepton number. And then we just imagine that there's some high scale that gives us very light Majorana masses for the active neutrinos. So now we have two sterile neutrinos, N1 and N2.
So this is a confusing notation. Right.
Yeah.
The first term should be written HLI at the R divided by the scale.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
And this is after, so this is after electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay, I see your point. Yeah. This part is after electroweak symmetry breaking, perhaps. But yeah, the point is basically we don't care too much about this physics or the physics behind that, those operators. So you'll see that, let's see, N1 couples to a linear combination of N2 and the light neutrinos, or the active neutrinos. But there is no Majorana mass that... I see. Okay. Yeah. So it's that's right. There is some tiny Majorana mass here. Yeah. Okay. But it's extremely tiny. Yeah. I forget which. I think that's right.
They have names doing 3x3 matrix. It must be a main.
Yeah.
Should we take any notice of the seesaw mechanism at all?
What's that, sorry?
The seesaw mechanism.
So the seesaw mechanism is contained within the
corpus. That requires a very heavy.
Sure.
10 to 15 GeV.
Maybe a bit less than that, but.
Maybe less.
Yeah. Something like that.
Space is not going to be detected in the near future.
Probably not, but. I mean, it's.
Well, why don't we see what the model does and then decide?
Then we'll see, yeah. Okay, so after we break electroweak symmetry, then the Higgs gets a BEV here, and it leads to a mass matrix involving the sterile neutrinos and the active neutrinos. It looks like this in the active N1, N2 basis. We also have an interaction between the sterile neutrinos and dark matter, as previously. There's this mass matrix is diagonalized by some mixing matrix U, which relates the mass eigenstates, which will occasionally have hats on them, to the flavor eigenstates, which don't have those hats. And then we can ask what the cross-section for scattering of the dark matter on the light neutrinos is. And it's essentially the same as the previous cross-section, but now this coupling is just the Yukawa coupling in the dark sector, and then the mixing angles that are elements of this mixing matrix. And the important thing is that these mixing angles are not related to the ratios of the heavy neutrino to the very light neutrinos. So the what would go wrong? So these guys are all left-handed, and N2 doesn't have the right lepton number to write down an interaction like this. So at some very high scale, lepton number is broken, but it's some symmetry, some accidental symmetry below that scale.
Okay. So if you erase Mij, you have a model of an extra heavy, you know, Dirac fermion that mixes with the left-handed stuff, still some of the probability, but does not create the mass pair for the mass
neutron. So yeah, in the limit that little Mij that's zero, then the heavy neutrino is Dirac. So it's, Maxime was saying, pseudo-Dirac in general, but little m is tiny.
I got a little lost. What kind of values for these scales do you have in mind?
So dark matter mass and mediator mass, tens of MeV, 100 MeV maybe. This coupling needs to be, say, 0.1. And so capital M, so do I have it on the next? No, I don't. The spectrum is a heavy, nearly Dirac neutrino. That's some mixture of N1 and a linear combination of one of the N2 and what heavy is say 100 MeV. Okay, and the mass of this is essentially M. There's some. It's not quite, but essentially M. This heavy neutrino decays invisibly, like this. So it also decays decays visibly through the usual weak processes. However, those are highly suppressed compared to this invisible decay. So we can ask. Since we need these mixing angles to be order 0.1, what values are allowed?
And so what are the ones?
These Yukawas. Yeah, they need to not be tiny. So are you worried about Landau poles or? Yeah.
Not natural, right? And from the loops, you generate
mass of 5.
So I don't think I have a slide about it, but the mass of phi that you would generate is of order MeV. So an MeV scale. Yeah, if you cut it 10 to EV. So, and then who knows? Natural. No, but this is a cheap shot I anticipate, so. Okay. So we can ask what the limits are on the mixing angles of the sterile neutrino with the active neutrinos as a function of the heavy neutrino mass. So there's a lower bound on this heavy neutrino that comes from CMB and BBN measurements of an effective that's roughly 10 MeV, say. So that's shown here. Then limits on the mixing angle with the electron neutrino are shown in orange here. So there's a limit from comparing the rate for pi to E nu to pi to mu nu. Looks like this. You can actually look for bumps in the pi to E nu spectrum. You get limits here. You can also set limits on the mixing with the muon neutrino. Those are in purple. You can look at pi to mu nu decays. You can look at k to mu nu decays. You can look at the spectrum of muon decay. You can compare the muon lifetime with values of the Fermi constant that you derive from high energy data. That gives you a limit like this. There's also a limit from extracting CKM elements using kaon decays and beta decays. And then there are limits on mixing with the tau neutrino. Those come from tau decays, essentially. Here's an estimate of the limit, the upper limit on the mixing that comes from shifts of the tau to mu rate. And then this limit is a limit from a fit that I did to Aleph data, where they looked at the spectrum in three-prong tau decays. So, if we need these things to be kind of order, this denominator to not be much smaller than 0.1, then essentially that singles out the mixing with the tau neutrino as the most promising. And so we have to be kind of living in this sort of a region, mixing with the tau neutrino. Okay. Then we can ask about constraints from neutrino oscillation experiments. So if we're mixing just with the, only appreciably with the tau neutrino, we can decompose this mixing matrix in the following way. So it's only four angles that are involved. So the last three matrices, that's the usual sort of parameterization of the PMNS, or one of the usual ones. And then we can ask what we know about the elements of this mixing matrix. So Dia Bay gives us a measurement of theta 1,3, which is small. So that's this element UE3 of the mixing matrix. It's unaffected by the in this parameterization, it doesn't tell us anything about this this other angle, theta tau. U mu 3 is best determined by muon neutrino disappearance experiments and atmospheric neutrinos. Also, this element doesn't tell us anything about theta tau. UE2 can be determined by looking at reactor neutrinos. That tells us this element. And the fact that these are all, these can all be expressed in a way that's independent of theta tau tells us that these all essentially have to be given by their usual sorts of values. So, theta 1,3 has to be small and the other two mixing angles are somewhat large. So there is a possible constraint from high energy neutrinos that are emitted from the sun. So because of the somewhat large matter interactions, they're electron neutrinos that are emitted, but they are they mostly leave the sun as the second mass eigenstate. So by comparing charged current and neutral current event rates, you can measure essentially the elements of this column here, corresponding to the second mass eigenstate. And comparing that to theoretical expectations of the boron 8 flux gives you a limit on how large this mixing angle with the tau neutrino can be. And it turns out that the sine of this thing is probably less than about 0.6 from that.
Which way does it go? It's
a little bit lower because you effectively you're decreasing by cos theta. But the other handle that you have on the mixing angle with the tau neutrino comes from the fact that so the light neutrinos are some admixture of nu e, nu mu, and a linear combination of sterol and tau neutrino. And so because of that, then the muon-type neutrino and the mostly tau neutrino have slightly different matter interactions. And so you can, there are matter effects that non-zero mixing angle will create. And SuperK has a recent analysis of their data looking for the effects of a heavy neutrino that has some tau neutrino component. And they limit this mixing angle to be less than about 0.4. So so essentially, this mixing angle is, this limit is more or less independent of the mass, the heavy neutrino. So that serves as some pretty robust upper bound. OK. So since we're strongly affecting the properties of neutrinos, we can ask what the effects are on supernovae, which are, you know, pretty intense sources of neutrinos. And essentially, adding this adding the dark matter just means that instead of a neutrino gas that you have sitting inside of the star before it leaves, it's a mixture of neutrino dark matter that's strongly interacting with itself. But in the same way that the cooling time does not of, say, 1987A, which we observe to be of the order of 10 seconds or so, if that cooling time is not strongly affected by strong neutrino self interactions, then the story more or less goes through when you add in dark matter. There is some, there's a possible complication due to the fact that the dark matter is somewhat heavy, and then as it's leaving the star, it can gravitationally redshift. And then the neutrinos that are trailing behind that slowed down dark matter can be degraded in energy. However, you can figure out what the temperature of the dark matter sphere is, and it seems to be somewhat lower than the dark matter mass, and so dark matter production is suppressed. So, this is something that we're looking at now in some amount of detail, and it'll probably be a separate project. But it's also, I should point out that other people have looked at similar scenarios. Faye, Hooper, and Siegel looked at a scenario where the dark matter was interacting strongly with both charged particles and neutrinos. And they find, so in some sense, this scenario should be more constrained than the one we're thinking about. And they find a lower limit on the dark matter mass of 10 MeV. These other groups also looked at dark matter neutrino interactions and found that actually the strongest constraints are not from the cooling time of the supernova, but from the potential absorption of neutrinos on their way from the supernova to us. And that sets an upper limit on the neutrino dark matter interaction.
Right.
Okay.
The interaction of dark matter, maybe I missed something, the interaction of dark matter is mostly with the top neutrino.
Yes.
So
it's only with the tau neutrino, but there is a tau component to all three light.
Right, and it's sufficient to keep it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, so, you know, these people found some upper limit on the cross-section for interaction of the dark matter with a neutrino. And it turns out that in this model, that cross-section, that limit is always satisfied except for some narrow region around a resonance, which is determined by the mass of the dark matter and the mass of this mediator. And because they both have to be of order tens of MeV, then that resonance is kind of right in the range of neutrinos, of energies of neutrinos that are emitted from supernovae. So that's somewhat interesting. So the statement is that there will be some degradation of the flux of neutrinos from a supernova. However, it's only neutrinos of a particular energy. So there's some feature in the spectrum, but not a decrease in the total flux. So you know, the 20 or so neutrinos that we observed from 1987 A are, so that doesn't rule out this scenario. But it does give a nice possible signal at a future supernova, whenever that happens. But and also in this, so you can.
The signal was composed of two parts, right? There was the part which is our initial burst.
Yeah.
And that's the only electron
neutrinos. That's right.
And there's the other part, which is more of a continuous spectrum, and that should be all three.
That's right. So the initial burst will also be affected because it's mostly electron neutrinos,
right.
But there are.
Is it only anti-neutrinos for the two electron neutrinos?
Right.
I think that's
but
right.
He's only coupled to
that's right.
Right. He's coupled only to tau neutrinos.
And I should say, since this is a scenario where the dark matter is asymmetric, only the neutrinos or only the antineutrinos scatter. The other, I didn't mention that anywhere, but that happens to be the case. Then, so, you know, the neutrinos are emitted from the supernova and then travel to us as the mass eigenstates, and there is some decrease in the flux that's related to the scattering of each of these mass eigenstates on the dark matter. And the fact that you're mixing mostly with the tau neutrino and the other observations of what the PMNS matrix elements are gives you a rough hierarchy of what mass eigenstates are most strongly affected by the dark matter. And so the third mass eigenstate happens to have the strongest interactions. And so one of the consequences of this, and the first mass eigenstate has the smallest interactions. And a consequence of this is that, so you deplete you know, the second and third eigenstates more than the first. And the first eigenstate has a lot more electron-type neutrinos in it. And so you increase the electron-neutrino fraction. And so here, we have shown a plot of that fraction for different values of this coupling. In other words, different values of this cutoff. And so there's some feature here that you can see at an energy that's corresponding to the resonance. And so that's one, you know, interesting possible signal of this scenario. Another possibility, or in this scenario, the diffuse supernova background is affected. So this was looked at in a effective field theory point of view by these people. And it's possible that for quite large values of the coupling.
What do you mean?
So they wrote down some non-renormalizable interaction and gauge non-invariant interaction. So they just said there's an interaction of neutrino, chi, and phi.
Okay.
and it has some strength G. But so I mean, essentially, it's quite similar actually to the model that we wrote down, but it's just not it doesn't have built in any of the other consequences. And for somewhat large values of this coupling, it's possible that Hyper-K might be able to observe that, observe the you know, this spectral feature. So far I've only, you know, talked about solutions to the missing satellite problem, but I'll also mention here possible implications for the core versus cusp problem from supernovae. So one of the possibilities that people invoke involving enhanced feedback of normal matter on dark matter involves supernovae that explode, push normal matter out, and then the dark matter, well, and then that normal matter recollapses eventually. And in the intervening time, the dark matter has moved out to a larger orbit. And then now, after the normal matter has recollapsed, the dark matter sees a smaller gravitational force. And so through this sort of a mechanism, you can imagine that you would kind of clear out a cuspy halo and turn it into something more cored. And so there are simulations where a parameter essentially is the fraction of supernova energy that's dumped into dark matter through this sort of a process. So typically supernovae are 10 to the 53 ergs. 10 to the 51 ergs is the amount of energy that's available in photons. So the 99% of the energy just leaves in neutrinos and doesn't do anything. And 1% is can interact with the surrounding normal matter. And so one parameter is the fraction of that 1% of a supernova's energy that can be transferred to the dark matter. And values of order, you know, 10% or something like that are interesting in the sense that they are potentially solutions to the core versus cusp problem. There are other people who, in their simulations, do funky things like...
But they transfer all the energy not for any interaction, but only gravity.
Yeah, so you might say, is this a large number? Yes. Yes, I would say. That's right. And yeah, so I was going to say there are other people who disagree with this who say things or do things in their simulations like take all of the normal matter and then move it out to 1 kiloparsec, wait, move it back in, and repeat this. And apparently that's not enough to, so that's some kind of super exaggerated version of this process. And they claim that doesn't solve it. So it's...
You can actually transfer energy by interacting with the outgoing neutrinos.
Right? That's right. Yeah, so that's the next slide, right? And the point is, so if we're thinking about neutrinos scattering on the dark matter, then we have access to 100 times more energy. You can estimate what that energy transfer is. And values of this thing that are 10 to the minus 3 seem reasonable. And you'll note that gives you about, you know, 10 to the 50 ergs or so, which is comparable to the value that people who are doing n-body simulations with supernova feedback, what they say happens to be interesting. So potentially this sort of mechanism is a way of, you know, obtaining a value for this energy transfer that's as large as what people would like. You can also, you know, do some rough back of the envelope calculation of how much energy it takes to go from some cuspy profile to a chord profile, and then get an estimate of what the how many supernovae you need given a fractional energy deposition in the dark matter. So, you know, this is at least suggestive that this is a possible explanation. We'll talk about, other future tests. So, like I was saying, it seems most promising to be coupling the dark matter preferentially to the sterile neutrino, which you have to do by making, the dark matter to the tau neutrino, which is most easily done by making some appreciable fraction of the tau neutrino heavy. So that means that, like I was saying before, tau decays are affected, in particular this three-prong decay of the tau. This is looked for as a measurement of the tau neutrino mass at LEP. And so you can do a fit of their data, and I showed what that that limit was before, but it would be nice if people revisited this. I can't help myself but to mention the fact that the rate for tau to kaon decays is a little bit lower than what one might expect. And this could be due to a heavy component to the tau neutrino. And since the kaon is relatively heavy, the decreased phase space affects these decays more more strongly. So that might be a nice, some hint from the particle physics point of view that something like this is going on. The limit on this mixing angle with the tau neutrino from super K is statistics limited. So this will hopefully improve. You can also get a measurement of, essentially the same phenomenon from Pingu. And there's an estimate that 3 years of data could improve that the limit on U tau 4 by a factor of 1.5. So it's possible that we might see this just around the corner. So I think I will conclude. There's signs that maybe the canonical cold dark matter paradigm doesn't work at small scales. One possible fix is coupling dark matter strongly to neutrinos. If you do so and you take these problems somewhat seriously, then that's telling you that there's essentially a bunch of new states that are kind of at the 100 MeV scale. It's probably easiest to do this by coupling mostly to the tau neutrino, and this has a lot of implications for tau decays, supernovae, and maybe other things. So thanks a lot.
Questions? Yes, John.
What about laboratory tests to see sterile neutrinos? Apparently, it's not easy to do.
So these depend on the typically then you observe kind of some heavy neutrino that's mostly sterile, just like in this case, and the signatures depend on the decay modes of that heavy neutrino, and that's model dependent. And so I showed basically what the strongest limits are on such a scenario in the case that the heavy neutrino decays invisibly.
Also, the heaviest dark matter, the heaviest object in the universe is a spheroidal dwarf galaxy. Can have very large master vibrations.
Yes.
And apparently there's some new data that bounds the limits, the amount of sterile neutrinos in such an object. Also the winds, by the way.
So Well, it depends. I mean, these could be limits on scenarios where the sterile neutrino is the dark matter. In this case, it's not, but so not. These sorts of limits are model dependent, I would say.
Any more questions?
So if I just take fermionic dark matter with a smallish mass, right? Do I also solve quark things because of the fermionic pressure?
The Fermi pressure. I think it would have to be a quite small mass, right?
Some keys.
But then it's warm dark matter as well.
Well, it depends on the
problem. Yeah.
I think that the bigger problem is this too big to fail problem. Because the cost, it is a pretty violent environment.
I should say that there are people who say that the those two problems are related, because whatever is getting rid of the cusp, less cuspy profiles imply velocities of stars that are smaller, which then decrease the estimates of the mass that of the halos that host these populations of stars, and so we could be underestimating the masses of the satellite galaxies.
It depends. There was no time matching before.
It would be better.
Yeah, it's an additional problem.
I don't know what better means.
Well, it means that there's no cusp. It's mainly dominated.
I think if one were to do some kind of like global chi-squared, it would be pretty bad without dark matter, right? Including CMB and so forth. That would be adverse, but.
All right. So,
before we get into global chi-squareds for different people's worldviews, so I'm curious about the feedback. In the normal situation, what's the physical mechanism for feedback going into the dark matter?
True. Sorry.
What's the idea?
Okay, so I kind of sort of sketched it out, but I can. All right, so this cartoon taken from a paper by people who do n-body simulations where they find numbers like this that are interesting. So the basic idea is So the supernova. Yeah. So here's
okay.
Here's initial. Here's final.
Okay.
So here's a test dark matter particle.
Right.
Moving around, it has some velocity. Supernova goes off, pushes some fraction of matter out. Then that matter kind of hangs out and cools and falls back in. In the meantime, the dark matter, the normal matter moves out. The dark matter feels less gravity, and so it goes out to a larger radius.
Yeah,
and it's.
The geometry of this cartoon sucks.
I
mean, if the bend is to the right, it should push the.
I think that there was a part that is.
No. So this is like an
okay.
This is panel one. This is panel
okay.
two. In between, there was a bang.
I see.
The
so
bang
then,
happened.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to see. Maybe it's easier.
The important thing is that there was
yeah.
a point where there was all the matter in the center got evacuated immediately. And so you're left with this. It's like a robot on a snake, thing over your head, and all of a sudden cutting the
symbols,
right?
So the dark matter particle gets unbound.
Right,
yeah.
From this, assuming it was actually bound mainly by gas rather than by dark matter
right.
to begin with.
Yeah.
And then that same, so all the normal matter flows outwards. At some point that stops, it starts migrating back, but that part is a adiabatic process, and the dark matter now at the larger radius.
Okay,
not
so the statement that they actually include in the n-body simulations is that a significant fraction of the time disrupting the visible matter is enough to unbind
right.
the dark some significant fraction of the dark matter particles.
Right, but
even though I would have naively thought that they should be bound just by the potentials of their fellow dark matter.
Not at the center. Not necessarily the center, right? At the center, you're not dominated by the dark matter.
Yeah.
Well, you're not dominated by dark matter. So you say if it's virialized, that means that if you took all the visual matter out.
But, yeah, these statements are not, I mean, reasonable people disagree about this, I would say.
Right, but this, I mean, there's the mechanism and then there in which they parameterize in some way, and then
yeah.
There's how you, whether it's reasonable to tune the parameter to
yeah.
0.1 to 0.4.
That's right. And then, yeah, so you can ask
these people, perhaps.
You can say, hey, is this number...
Aren't they in your
institution?
Or the youth of the
Hansen, I think, was, Fabio is, but he works essentially from a coffee shop always. this is recorded, isn't it? Yeah, you can ask these people if this number is reasonable, and then they say, well, you know, it's really a product of this parameter times, like, supernova rates, star formation rates, how efficiently the stuff cools, things like that. And so, you know, that's the answer. All
right.
But I think in the scenario that we're outlining, it seems to me that it's, you know, some other semi-efficient mechanism of transferring energy from a supernova into dark matter. And this is just to get some normalization of
right. No, I mean this mechanism that if there's neutrino dark matter coupling, that you know, that changes everything. That makes good sense.
All right. So we'll have David for the rest of the day and
tomorrow morning, like till 12.
Okay, and we'll have dinner tonight in bistro. So,
great.
And that's it.
Thank you.